nothing to do with drawing in new viewers. The rating jumped simply because the viewers who had left in September to watch the NFL were returning from their annual hiatus. Long story short, Russo was about to find himself looking like the company's savior. But all was not so peachy. Taking away an extra hour of Nitro meant that the company was also taking away an entire hour of advertising revenue. In order not to lose money, this change meant that Nitro had to add one-third of its rating to the other 2 hours. Since the show was averaging a 3.2 at this point, this meant that the move to 2 hours and the elimination of football competition would have to bump Nitro all the way up to a 4.5 or 4.7. Even those who knew the game doubted that things could change so dramatically. Ratings aside, business was hardly exploding under Russo. By the end of December 1999, Nitro was averaging a miserable 5,000 paid. Worse, the December 14 Thunder from Mobile, Alabama, drew only 1,797 fans. Despite what anyone claimed, clearly none of the wrestlers was over with the fans, because merchandise sales, which had been as strong as $10 per head at the company's peak, were now in the $4 range. The buy rate for Starrcade, the biggest show of the year, came in at a dismal 0.3, which was especially pathetic since they'd had over a month to build up the quest of their biggest star, Goldberg, toward the WCW title. Russo, again, insisted that a turnaround was going to take time. The first Nitro of 2000 from Greenville, South Carolina, in front of only 4,966 fans, looked pretty much like almost every Nitro of 1999. That is, it was horrid and illogical on every level. The big angle on the program was the introduction of Terry Funk as the new WCW commissioner. The fans were so excited to see Funk that they immediately began chanting, "We want Flair." In real life, Flair and the company were yet again at odds, and in the storyline, he had been buried in the desert. And no, that's not a joke. The show was built around a tournament for the World Tag Team titles, and for some perverse reason, Russo booked it in such a manner as to make the WCW title tournament look stellar in comparison. The matches themselves were abysmal, and the worst team on the roster, David Flair and Crowbar, beat Nash and Scott Steiner in the finals. The finish saw Arn Anderson, now Funk's enforcer, hit Nash with a crowbar, the physical object, not the wrestler of the same name, leading to the pin. Afterwards, David attacked Arn, no doubt as a way to thank him for helping them win the tag belts. And then, Nash and Steiner beat up Funk as well. If you're wondering why Funk was beaten up on his first day in, the answer is that the show was in the Carolinas. You see, Flair was supposed to be the commissioner, and was therefore scheduled to take the beating to once again be humiliated in front of his hometown crowd. Since he refused, Funk took his place in the pummeling. This Nitro was the first to be cut to 2 hours, so everyone eagerly awaited the ratings to see if the show would jump up to the 4.5 or 4.7 range needed to make it worthwhile. Finally, it came in. 3.29. Yes, the exact same number that they'd been doing at 3 hours. To say people were appalled and horrified would be quite the understatement. The ratings weren't the only thing taking a pummeling. On January 4th, during a hardcore match with Terry Funk on Thunder, Bret Hart took several blows to the head with various objects, including trash cans. Bret had been taking quite the beating over the past few weeks, as a Starrcade encounter with Goldberg saw him take a brutal kick to the head that caused a concussion. Figuring it was really no big deal, he continued to wrestle over the course of the next few weeks, and because his brain had swollen, he suffered another minor concussion every time he took a major hit to the head. Shortly after the Funk match, he penned a column for the Calgary Sun newspaper. He'd been writing columns for some time, but had taken several weeks off without explanation. "A couple of weeks ago, I ended my column by saying that I'd have some explaining to do," he began. "I haven't written since then because I had a lot on my mind, and I wasn't sure how to say it." In detail, Bret described how much wrestling had changed and how he felt the sport had passed him by. He wrote about the superkick from Goldberg at Starrcade, and how, in the following weeks, he'd had a very physical match with Chris Benoit, a match with Jerry Flynn in which he got kicked full force in the ribs, and finally, the hardcore match with Funk. I signed an autograph for a guy who asked me the ever-present, "Is it fake?" question, and I was stunned to realize that I'm not even sure I know the answer anymore. Is what fake? The lump on my head is sure real enough. He was also outraged about having been asked to drive the monster truck that ran over Sid's car, and about another angle that required him to screech out of the arena in a getaway car. I'm flooring it, tearing out of backstage, with no time in the scene to even put on a seatbelt, and it turns out an icy rain had coated the ramp. There I am, careening out of control, toward a huge trailer truck filled with television equipment. In the last moment, I was somehow able to swerve to safety. He said this was made worse by the fact that, on that same night, Goldberg had cut his arm all to shreds on the limo window. In the old days, nothing like this would have ever happened in wrestling. "I'm a wrestler, not a stuntman," he wrote. "And even a stuntman has time to strap himself in. I'm a professional wrestler, and I get paid to wrestle in a ring. What am I doing fighting in the back, taking falls on concrete, and doing stunts and speeding cars?" He said he was especially appalled to think that he was doing the same sort of thing that had resulted in his brother Owen's death. "So what's the point of all of this?" he concluded. "I'm not sure I know. I just know I've emptied my head and my heart, and this is as real as it gets. Maybe the whole wrestling business is pathetic, including me." A week after the Thunder match with Funk, Brett went to the doctor. He was diagnosed with a concussion so severe that his doctor banned him from doing pretty much everything, including lifting weights and flying in airplanes. Wrestling was absolutely out of the question. Sadly, it would turn out that after an illustrious 24-year run, Bret Hart's final official match, at least for a decade, was a lame no contest with Kevin Nash on the January 10 Nitro. Bret immediately called the office and told them the news. Since he was WCW champion and obviously wouldn't be able to defend the belt against Sid, whom he'd had the temerity to accuse of being a big stupid dummy at Sunday's sold-out pay-per-view, the decision was made to strip him of the title. The next day, Jeff Jarrett called up and said he had a concussion as well, suffered when he took a splash from the 56-year-old Jimmy Snuka off the top of a cage 4 nights earlier on Nitro. Right there, the company was out 4 matches, because Jarrett and Chris Benoit was scheduled for a best-of-3 series. The pay-per-view was dead. Lesson learned. It's hard for us as authors to read back through repeated references to Chris Benoit. We understand that you, the reader, may also have issues with this. What may be harder still is seeing how many concussions are noted in these pages. The book is littered with so many tragedies that could have been avoided. Thankfully, not only in wrestling, but also in nearly every real sport, head injuries are now being taken very seriously. It may have been painful, but it is a lesson that seemingly has been learned. As for Benoit, we have chosen to leave him in this book. While we understand why WWE has chosen to whitewash him from their canon, we consider this more of a historical account. We have also done this for other deceased wrestlers. We hope you, the reader, can understand why we have done so. Russo, the insane genius, came up with a plan, and it truly was insane. There would be a battle royal to crown a new champion at the pay-per-view, and the eventual winner would be someone nobody would have predicted going in. Tank Abbott. The real reason nobody would have predicted this is that nobody was quite stupid enough to think that WCW would make Tank Abbott, the shoot fighter WCW had hired the previous year, who hadn't connected with the fans at all, the world heavyweight champion. Tank Abbott was a tough, tough man. Sure, he had the worst record of anyone in the history of the Ultimate Fighting Championships, but he'd beaten the shit out of many people for real, and when he was allowed to cut loose on the mic, he was a charismatic guy. The problem was that WCW was not UFC. WCW was a place where Tank Abbott had no idea what he was doing. He couldn't wrestle, couldn't sell, and couldn't cut much of a promo. Worse, for the majority of his wrestling career, he hadn't been booked as a badass killer. He'd been booked as just another guy, and a non-wrestling, no-selling guy who wasn't good on the stick was hardly the type of person that fans would take seriously as champion. Even Bill Bush, who knew nothing about wrestling, knew it was a stupid idea. This, combined with the fact that guys had been in his ear for months telling him that Vinnie Roux was an idiot, led him to remove Russo from his position as head writer. In a move that was probably designed to get him to quit, Bush told him that he could stay on as part of a booking committee with Kevin Sullivan, J.J. Dillon, and Terry Taylor, similar to the committees he worked on in WWF when he actually did help turn the place around. Russo quit, or, more precisely, since he was under a long-term deal, he just went home and continued to collect his checks. To finally settle any dispute about what Vince Russo accomplished in WCW, let's look at his run from a pure numbers standpoint. Final tally from day one to his departure in January 2000 looked like this. Nitro went from a 3.08 average to a 3.10, although it was realistically a 2.9 since the 3.10 was for the new two-hour show. Don't forget, this also resulted in the loss of tons of advertising revenue since they deleted the third hour. Average attendance fell from 4,628 per show to 3,593, due largely to the fact that the company had failed to create any new stars and had made their previous draws, such as Ric Flair and Goldberg, look like total idiots. Buy rates, the company's main revenue source, plummeted from 0.52 to 0.26. That is not a typo. Buy rates actually dropped by half. Hardly a stellar track record. In all fairness, however, he did help boost Thunder from a 2.06 to a 2.32. And if you want to compare his reign with the reign of the men who followed him, well, they were both about equally horrible. Bam Bam Bigelow said, "Russo was the worst. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. I don't know how he flim-flammed WCW by saying, 'Hey, I'm the guy who made Vince McMahon. You have to hire me. I need to run your company.' What a scumbag. Russo's the biggest asshole in the world. He didn't know what the hell he was talking about. He was the worst. Ever. With Russo gone, everything fell into complete chaos. The company scrambled to come up with new ideas for the pay-per-view, and some of them, quite frankly, were almost as stupid as the Tank Abbott deal. For example, one idea was for Nash to beat Funk and become commissioner, and then, in his very first act, say that Scott Hall was the number one contender and would face Sid for the belt. Hall, however, would be in Florida drinking, in the storyline, or maybe not, to be honest, and so Nash would announce that the number two contender was getting the shot. That, of course, would be Nash himself, and he'd win the title. Nash, knowing how unpopular he already was in the locker room, turned it down. Finally, they decided to give the shot to Benoit. Sadly, there was a flaw in this plan. Benoit hated Sullivan, who was now more or less the head of the booking committee. In fact, Benoit and at least 14 others hated him so much that they all got together the Saturday night before the pay-per-view and decided to ask for their releases. Their main gripe was that when Sullivan had been briefly in charge of booking the year prior, he had done everything in his power to keep the mid-carders down, and there was no reason to believe that he'd do any differently this time around. By Sunday afternoon, half of the wrestlers had changed their minds, probably for fear of losing their guaranteed deals without any other concrete offers on the table. The WWF likely would have taken some, but not all of them, and most were unwilling to gamble their financial security on it. So Benoit, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Perry Saturn, Conan, Billy Kidman, and Shane Douglas all went to Bush as a group and said they wanted out. Bush, totally unprepared for this, told them to please wait a week and he'd try to handle the situation. Even though Benoit had asked for his release, they still went with the original plan and had him win the belt from Sid with his crossface submission at Sold Out, in Sid's best match since 1996, which really isn't saying much. Sid's foot was underneath the bottom rope while he was locked in the submission, which, in traditional wrestling rules, should have meant that the hold had to be broken and the match should have continued. What should have been a ploy to set up future matches between the two ended up being used as an excuse to explain why, 18 hours later, Benoit was no longer champion. Before Nitro, Bush tried to reason with everyone. He said that if they stayed, he'd take Sullivan off Nitro and Thunder, and put him in charge of only WCW Saturday Night, which none of them would ever have to work on. That seemed to be cool with everyone. Then, a few hours later, Bush called everyone except Benoit back into his office and said they were being sent home. When Benoit found out, he said if they were being sent home, he was going as well. Bush, obviously trying to play to Benoit's ego, said the plan was for him to beat three men on Nitro en route to retaining his WCW championship. Benoit, wisely seeing the belt as a prop in Bush's plan, and nothing more, repeated his statement. If everyone else was going home, so was he. He would, however, drop the belt to whomever they chose on TV before doing so. In their seemingly never-ending quest to destroy the credibility of their world title, they told Benoit to just go home. He left the belt with referee Nick Patrick on his way out. That night on Nitro, the announcers basically told the truth. The title was being held up because Sid's foot had been under the ropes, and because they truly didn't know what his status was, fans would have to tune into Thunder to find out. 1 week later, in what came as a shock to many, Bush actually lived up to his word and sent Benoit, Malenko, Guerrero, Saturn, Douglas, and Conan unconditional releases. Conan and Douglas did not sign, due to the fact that both had bad blood with the WWF from years back. Conan had been scheduled to be the original Max Moon in a deal that fell apart, and Douglas had left on bad terms in 1995, and they were therefore unlikely to get jobs there. The big question remains, how were they able to escape with a completely unconditional release when others had tried in the past and been denied? We had some ammunition in our pockets that forced WCW to give us full releases, Eddie Guerrero noted in his autobiography. When we said we wanted out, one of the WCW road agents got pissed off and threatened to, quote, slice our throats. He was just talking out of anger, but it allowed us to go to Turner's Human Resources Department and say, look, one of your employees threatened to kill us if we left. Either take out the no-compete stipulation or we'll sue. Needless to say, Chris, Dean, Perry, and I were given full unconditional releases. We were officially free agents. So yes, the four were released and found themselves the focal points of the January 31 edition of Raw. Most would look at this story as typical WCW ineptitude. But in reality, this was much more significant. The departure of the four was a huge nail in the coffin of WCW. While they weren't the biggest stars or the most charismatic guys on the roster, they were the heart of the company. Four young guys who should have been given a chance to run with the ball in 1997 and 1998 when it was time to create a new generation. All of them, Benoit in particular, considered by many to be the best technical wrestler in the world, were workhorses who went out there every night and did the absolute best they could under what were usually the worst of circumstances. In early 2000, WCW didn't have a lot left. Really, the only thing they could brag about in comparison to the WWF was a strong roster of workers. When they lost these four, they lost those bragging rights and were left with virtually nothing. Perry Saturn said, I wanted to get out of there at any cost. WCW was very unorganized. I can't tell you how many times I would be on the road and they'd forget to buy my ticket home. So I'd have to buy the ticket home, and they'd have to reimburse me. Or I'd go to the airport to go to a show, and there wouldn't be a ticket for me. It was all just so unorganized. Saturn's complaints about the travel arrangements were not unique, as the company would routinely double or triple book travel for talent. One source noted, he'd have two or three versions of an itinerary. And yes, that meant the guy would have two or three airline tickets. The solution? The airlines would credit the tickets and would say the money could be used for future tickets or, get this, SkyMall credit. Yes, the magazine with the overpriced trinket crap the airlines put in the seat pocket on all the flights. Amazingly, the source noted, He'd rather use the free credit for family vacations than to buy a life-sized garden Yeti. Malaya Osaka, who worked for WCW when they started their new women's division in 1996, confirmed the above with a story of her own. When they decided to fly me into Duluth, Minnesota to work with Medusa, they sent me 2 full fare tickets. I think they were $2,400 each. I used one to go to the show and traded the other in and used it for about a year to get to other indie shows, and the indie promoters paid me for the tickets to get there. It was one of the few times I can say I actually made money in the biz rather than taking a loss. Those backstage in WCW downplayed the loss of Benoit and Company, saying the 4 would get lost in the shuffle due to their size and their lack of interview skills. They were just, quote, the vanilla midgets. They also had what they thought was an ingenious backup plan. The reintroduction, or digging up in storyline, of Ric Flair. Where did it take place, you ask? On a huge, heavily hyped Nitro event. Perhaps a show unopposed by Raw? Or the Super Brawl pay-per-view? Of course not. It took place with no hype on the January 25 Thunder from Las Vegas, which was, in fact, where Ric Flair had been buried in the storyline, so for once, WCW had some level of continuity. His big role on the show was to go out and say good job to Sid for having regained the WCW title from Kevin Nash. The whole process of Sid losing and winning the belt was so convoluted that we won't explain it here for fear of causing serious brain damage to readers. Okay, we will. But be forewarned that it is so baffling, it almost makes the previous year's Flair-Piper Insane Asylum storyline seem logical in comparison. After Benoit left, Terry Taylor announced on Thunder that there was going to be an NWO versus WCW match on the January 24th Nitro for the vacant title. Sid, he announced, was the WCW representative, and the NWO was going to be able to choose whomever they pleased. Nash, the commissioner, chose Jarrett. Buddy said if Sid beat Jarrett, he wouldn't get the belt. Instead, he'd get a match with Nash for the belt. If Jarrett won, Nash would presumably just get the belt via forfeit. Nitro came, and it was announced that Jeff Jarrett couldn't wrestle yet, because of his snooker-induced concussion. So Nash said that Sid had to beat Don Harris instead in order to win the shot against him for the title later. Confused yet? Gets even more ridiculous. During the Sid versus Don match, Don switched places with his twin brother, Ron. Sid pinned Ron. During the commercial break, however, and keep in mind this was therefore not seen by fans at home, it was announced that Sid had beaten the wrong guy and had to return to beat the right one. He didn't return, so he was counted out. Logically, this should have meant that Don Harris was the new WCW champion. Or Nash was. Who knows? Anyway, since this happened during the break, on TV they pretended that it had never happened. So, in the main event, Sid got his title shot against Nash anyway, in the most horrendous match since, well, the last time they had a horrendous match, which was at Starrcade the month prior. This particular technical classic was highlighted by them screwing up the very first move they tried, which was a body slam. Jarrett ran out and accidentally hit Nash with a guitar, allowing Sid to get the pin and become the new WCW World Champion. A mess, to be sure, but at least WCW had an undisputed champion. Well, actually they didn't. After all this went down, it was announced on Thunder that Sid had in fact pinned the wrong Harris twin. So Nash ruled that he, meaning Nash, was the champion. He then signed a new main event, himself and the Harris twin that Sid hadn't beaten, that would be Don, we think, versus Sid in a cage match for the title. He made sure to note that the only way Sid could win the belt was to pin both himself, meaning Nash, though by this point we wouldn't have put it past WCW bookers to have Sid actually pin himself, and Ron. Sid managed to beat both Nash and Harris, thankfully putting an end to perhaps the most nonsensical and convoluted storyline in the history of wrestling. Or, at least in WCW, that particular week. Flair made his return to Nitro on January 31, head-to-head with the debuting Radicals, the new team name given to Benoit, Malenko, Guerrero, and Saturn on Raw. Despite the fact that the ex-WCW guys had been portrayed as mid-carders for years and told in no uncertain terms that they could never draw as main eventers, Raw did a 6.59 rating to Nitro's 2.79. Those who argued that Raw was just hot and the number had nothing to do with the arrival of Benoit and company were about to be in for a big surprise. The rest of Nitro, with the exception of Flair's interview and subsequent brawl with Terry Funk, was just as miserable as ever. As a dig on the departed Russo, there was a storyline in which Lenny and Lodi abandoned their standards and practices gimmick, and Stacy Keibler said she was done playing Miss Hancock. These gimmicks were stupid, they said, and WCW sucked. The few fans who were still watching the shows agreed. Many, however, had heard WCW performers say the promotion sucked for so long that they started to believe it, and then they stopped watching altogether. On the January 17 Nitro, it appeared that WCW had actually happened upon a match that the fans wanted to see. A bout between Dallas Page and Buff Bagwell caused the quarter-hour rating to jump from a 2.7 to a 3.9. WCW looked at that number, which was higher than any quarter they had drawn in months, and responded by killing the feud instantly, telling both guys that they were instead going to become friends and tag team partners. Why? Who knows? And both Page and Bagwell were stupefied. Even with Russo gone, the string of stupid storylines continued. One angle featured Big T, who had several years earlier been the WWF's Ahmed Johnson, filing a lawsuit against Booker T, claiming that he owned the rights to the letter T. Big T would eventually win the bout, and the letter, in a match that would have been a main event on any episode of Sesame Street. The February 7 ratings war, if you can even call it that, was something else. Nitro, which should have seen its ratings increase automatically after having eliminated a full hour, instead drew an abysmal 2.66. The only number even remotely in that neighborhood was the final show of the Nash era, which drew a 2.61. However, that show was 3 hours long, so realistically, this was the lowest number in years. Raw, on the other hand, had a 6.49 rating, peaking at an 8.11. That's right, for the former Vanilla Midgets and DX versus Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. Not only that, but 25% of Nitro's audience switched to Raw when the show went off the air. Suddenly, Bill Bush was looking like a bigger fool than ever. Poor Bush. Besides having to deal with criticism over how he handled the Benoit situation, he also had to deal with the money pit that WCW had become. Hearing that the company had lost more money in 1 year than in all 3 years of Jim Herd's Reign of Terror put together, he decided to cut costs. But fear not, he had a plan. Get this. They'd only fly in the guys who were going to work on a given show. Yes, it sounds incredible, but it's true. Believe it or not, up until this point, they were literally buying airline tickets to each event for the entire roster of 160 or so performers, but using only 20 to 30 of them during a show. Now, they would only fly in the folks they were going to actually use. Very clever and truly a revolutionary concept for WCW. At this point, the company had no clue what to do, so they turned to the man who claimed to have always been their savior, Hulk Hogan. Having been absent since Halloween Havoc, Hogan made his big return on Thunder for no explicable reason. Even less explicable was the fact that when he returned, he made no mention of Halloween Havoc, no mention of why he'd walked out on the match with Sting, and no mention of where he'd been, though he did manage in the span of 2 minutes to say the word brother 5 times, dude 4 times, and Jack 2x. In this epic speech, he also talked about how the younger guys like Lex Luger, a spry 41 at the time, needed to go because they thought they were stars. He attacked both Luger and Liz when they came out, giving the latter the single worst atomic drop in the history of wrestling. she sold it by gently patting her own ass. Amazingly, that wasn't even the worst bump on the show. The company had been building up a new wrestler named The Machine, who was scheduled to debut later in the night against Dallas Page. They had your typical 1980s prelim bout, with Machine climbing to the top rope to do some sort of wacky high-flying stunt. Page, however, bonked into the ropes just before he took flight, so Machine was supposed to crotch the top turnbuckle. Instead of immediately doing so, Machine did the following. First, he stood up from his crouched position. Then he uttered a scream of terror. Finally, he jumped, literally about 6 feet from the top turnbuckle, and crotched himself on the ropes. It is unlikely that anyone who saw this could ever possibly forget it, and Page was said to still be laughing about it months later. And in his big debut that they'd been hyping up all night, Machine got pinned and was never seen again. In an effort to give the younger guys something to do, Evan Courageous, Shane Helms, and Shannon Moore were dubbed Three Count and given a boy band gimmick. They would come out and sing and dance to the delight of, well, no one in particular. The highlight of their run came when Courageous said that Three Count's first album, which was not available anywhere, had somehow gone platinum, and that their next album, which would be even bigger, was going to go gold. In the music industry, platinum outranks gold, and you think Jimmy Hart, of all people, who came up with the Three Count gimmick, would have known that, particularly since, in another life, he played in the band The Gentrys, best known for the hit song, Keep On Dancin'. While misery was widespread in WCW that year, not everyone was miserable. Helms later said that while he found the addition of Tank Abbott to Three Count kind of goofy, quote, "To be honest, they treated me great." There was no such comedy the following Monday as the performers, watching WCW die around them, began to openly lash out at both the company and each other. Scott Steiner cut an unscripted promo on Nitro that totally buried Ric Flair, although not literally this time. Steiner went on a rampage, calling Flair, among other things, a, quote, "jealous, old, ass-kissing, butt-sucking bastard." He said that the previous week when Flair came out on TV, everyone watching at home turned to Raw to watch Steve Austin because WCW sucked. He ran it for so long that the format for the show went right out the window, and several pre-taped segments had to be axed. His punishment was to be suspended from Thunder. With pay, of course. Steiner wasn't the only one on the warpath this week, as Hogan did an appearance on the Bubba the Love Sponge radio show, and once again ripped WCW apart. He went after Billy Kidman, saying he wouldn't be able to headline a wrestling show at a flea market. A few weeks later, in another interview, he ripped apart most of the roster, saying no one under the age of 40 could draw. It seemed that even WCW.com was against Kidman. The website would commonly post, quote, "best match" polls every night after Nitro. The polls, however, were strange, in that if fans voted for, say, Booker versus Kidman, credit would go to Sid versus Abbott instead. Sometimes the polls were so weird that if you voted for Kidman, a main eventer would get the votes and poor Kidman would actually lose votes. Hogan's interview made clear two of the problems in the organization at the time. First, nobody under 40 could draw, and it should be mentioned that Goldberg was under 40 and had been quite the draw for a long time before his legs were cut off, because nobody over the age of 40 had made any effort to turn them into superstars back when things were hot. Second, nobody over the age of 40 was drawing anymore either, because the lack of new stars had led fans to tune out in droves. The worst part about all of this was that when Hogan had signed with WCW, he'd given them a creative control clause that pretty much allowed him to book his own storylines, so the company was resigned to catering to his whims until at least 2001, when the contract expired. To be fair, it should be noted that too much emphasis was placed, and still is at times, on the chronological age of the wrestlers. The real problem was not their actual age, but their TV age, or how many times they'd been in a prominent spot on television over the course of a year. For example, in early 2000, with only a few exceptions, all the top stars in the WWF were under 35. Just 3 years later, though, the newly dubbed WWE was experiencing the same problem WCW had in 1999. The top stars had become stale. It wasn't as if the top stars went from age 29 to 49 in the span of 3 years, though. They were only 3 years older. But because WWE was putting on 4 hours of television every single week, the main eventers had appeared in approximately 300 main events. And in TV years, they had become just as old and stale as the 45-year-olds who were killing WCW's business in 1999. Not only that, but in 1997, WCW's top stars were in their 40s, and the company was killing the WWF business-wise. If it was all about age, that shouldn't have happened, since the main WWF stars were years and sometimes decades younger. Instead of arguing about old guys versus young guys, or the need to elevate young wrestlers, the argument should be about fresh versus stale, and the need to elevate new faces, regardless of their actual age, to the top of the cards. Never was this more evident than at the Super Brawl pay-per-view on February 20th, as Hogan against Luger and Flair against Funk were both featured in main event matches. A year earlier, the two of them facing off against each other drew a $550,000 house and a 1.1 buy rate. Just 365 days later, they helped draw a $177,324 house and a 0.15 buy rate. If ever there was proof that running with a pat hand for too long was death, this was it. The Super Brawl main event saw Sid beat Scott Hall and Jeff Jarrett in a three-way to retain the WCW title. In a strange coincidence, Hall took a guitar shot from Jarrett and a powerbomb from Sid and was injured for real. The reason this was so weird was because everyone was sure that as soon as both guys walked through the curtain after the match, Hall was going to be fired. Earlier in the week, on a flight to Germany for a tour, he had gotten so messed up that he wasn't even allowed to board a plane back to the U.S. They just happened to get the same flight crew going back as they had going over, and they said there was no way they'd spend another 16 hours with this man. Consequently, he missed the Nitro that aired 6 days before his scheduled pay-per-view main event. On top of that, prior to the Thunder taping the next night, he claimed he was going to hit Terry Taylor with a guitar during an angle. And because Terry took this as a serious threat, Hall was pulled off the show. Because of this, the program started late. And to kill time, ring announcer Dave Penzer entertained the crowd with horrible jokes for 40 minutes. Everyone thought this was it for sure. But because Hall claimed a spinal injury and scheduled an MRI for February 22nd, he was not fired. It should be noted that, spinal injury or not, Hall thought there was no chance of him ever being fired. He told friends that he was just in, quote, time out, and that the company couldn't afford to lose him because he was too valuable a witness in the WWF versus WCW trademark infringement lawsuit. The show also made it apparent that the crutch of using celebrities didn't help matters either. The third match on the show featured The Wall versus The Kiss Demon in what was billed as a, quote, special main event. The Demon was a wrestler Eric Bischoff debuted in 1999 as part of the deal with Gene Simmons, in which the band was paid $500,000 for a 2.13-quarter hour. As part of the agreement, WCW was required to use the Demon in a certain number of main event matches. In reality, they gave up on the Kiss Demon, Dale Torborg, within, 1 week, leaving him as nothing but a jobber with a fancy ring entrance, doing third match on the card, quote, main events. A much less costly, and perhaps even more idiotic, celeb miscue happened later in the show. For months, WCW wrestler Ernest the Cat Miller had proclaimed himself the godfather of WCW, dancing to the ring to a tune reminiscent of many James Brown hits. He claimed that he knew James Brown and that he'd bring him out to the ring one day. He did this on a weekly basis, and no one believed that Brown would ever show up. However, James Brown did in fact show up at Super Brawl. But since WCW never promoted this, fans at home didn't find out about it until the following night on Nitro. Inexplicably, the company kept Brown's appearance a secret, so he was ultimately paid $25,000 to show up, dance, and bring no additional viewers with him. The only other highlight of the show was a match between Tank Abbott and a guy named Big Al that no one had ever heard of before. Or since, come to think of it. At the end of their leather jacket on a pole match, Tank pulled a knife on Al and screamed, quote, "I could fucking kill you!" He then placed the knife squarely on Al's throat as the cameras quickly cut away. Tony Schiavone, thinking on his feet, came up with a remarkable explanation. Tank, he said, was just trying to shave Al's beard. Unfortunately for Tony, Al had no beard. Nitro and Thunder were just boring shows for the next few weeks. It's hard to determine whether they were better or worse than Russo's horrible shows, because at least the latter were comically horrible. Fans used to spend those 2 hours debating whether to laugh or to cry. But now, the 2 hours began to just drag on and on and on. Actually, there is a business answer to that question. These boring shows were worse. Far worse. The February 28 Nitro did a 2.57 rating, its lowest in years, versus Raw's 6.50. Yes, Raw nearly tripled their number. At one point in the evening, it was 6.70 to 1.89 in Raw's favor. Then, on March 6th, they drew 22.36 paid to the Chapel Hill, North Carolina Nitro. Keep in mind, a year earlier, they had sold out all 16,000 seats in this building the very first day tickets went on sale. Bret Hart, who had been severely injured in the line of duty, was sent a letter informing him that he'd been on the shelf for so long that they were cutting his pay in half. Not only that, but as of April 15, they could fire him. He wasn't fired, but the pay cut stipulation ended up being a huge source of controversy. The deal, which was written into most of the contracts, was that if you got hurt and were going to be out for a long time, your pay was cut in half until you were able to return. Actual sports stars out in the real world could not believe their ears when they heard this. WCW's argument was that these guys were making huge money, and if they didn't want to work, they could just claim an injury, sit at home, and still make a ton of money. WCW did not realize two things. The first is that as bad as WCW was, the vast, vast majority of the wrestlers, even those who hated the environment, still loved to perform and weren't going to stay off television any longer than absolutely necessary. And second, the threat of pay cuts did far more harm than good, since it led many guys to return to action way before they were healthy enough to do so, which in turn led to more injuries, more pain pill addictions, and, in a few cases, tragedy. With business in the toilet domestically, WCW turned to Europe for help. The week of March 13th was actually a spectacular one for the company, because fans across the pond were starved for wrestling. In England, as a result, they drew the biggest houses since their U.S. peak. 11,812 in Birmingham, 10,450 in London, and 16,318 in Manchester. After these tremendous successes, they came back home and made absolutely zero mention of them on either Nitro or Thunder. Europe was where the good news ended. The March 13th Nitro, the latest in a string of boring, nothing-happening shows, set a new record low, a 2.53 against Raw's 6.28. And then came Uncensored, which in years past had garnered the reputation of being one of the worst pay-per-view events of the year. This was no exception. The show was miserable, exposing once again all that was wrong with the company. You would think that by now every glaring mistake would have been obvious and the Bookers would have made a strong effort to turn things around. You'd be wrong. The first day tickets were made available, WCW grossed about $90,000 in sales. They then did weeks of horrible television, building up the show, and adding wacky stipulations to many of the matches. When Showtime finally rolled around, they'd sold $97,925 worth of tickets. Amazingly, all that TV, all those angles, everything, resulted only in approximately 200 additional tickets being sold. This was the epitome of television writing that sold almost literally no tickets. It was one horrible match after another. If you take star ratings seriously, exactly one of the first 10 matches broke the 2-star mark. Then Hogan beat Flair in the main event in a strap match. The rules of this match were that in order to win, you had to drag your opponent around the ring and touch all 4 ring posts in succession. The announcers calmly explained this to all of the confused fans at home. So, what happened at the finish? Hogan hit Flair with the leg drop of doom and pinned him, and then he won a second time by touching all 4 corners. Remember 1 year and 1 month earlier, the exact same Hogan versus Flair match, minus the strap stipulation, had drawn a 1.1 buy rate? At Uncensored 2000, it drew a 0.13, nearly a 90% drop-off in business in just over 1 year. Despite the atrocious numbers, it was clear the Hulk Hogan show was starting again. This time the big feud was against another bright, up-and-coming young star, Sid Vicious, another dude as stale to fans as a bag of moldy bread. On the bright side, he was very charismatic, but certainly not charismatic enough to anyone in the world except the goofs running WCW to be considered a world champion, which he was. In what can only be described as a miracle, Sid and Hogan actually did a great angle on Nitro the following evening. Clips aired of Sid at a press conference. He was happily answering questions when Hogan walked in and started taking over. As the Hulkster yapped away, Sid just stood there, smiling like it was no big deal. But you could tell it was a fake smile, and he was boiling inside. Of course, this was method acting at its finest, since Hogan really was the sort of guy who stole the spotlight from everyone else, and Sid had to pretend that he was cool with it. Funniest part of all of this, by the way, was that Hogan was supposed to be the babyface. Finally, at the end of the night, Sid snapped. All was not completely well, however. The match he snapped in saw him team with Hogan to take on Jeff Jarrett and Scott Steiner. He went crazy, chokeslammed Hogan, and then pinned him. Yes, he pinned his own partner. The referee even counted. Nobody in WCW bothered to explain how this was possible, but it didn't matter because fans had long since given up on trying to find any logic in WCW storylines. Following this latest debacle, the tables turned again. Brad Siegel, who oversaw the wrestling division, decided to shake up the power structure by bringing Russo and Bischoff back together to head creative. Bill Bush, outraged, said that if Bischoff came back, he'd quit. Siegel didn't believe him, so Bush quit. This was not good news. Siegel, having seen the $15 million that WCW lost in 1999 under Bischoff, made it very clear that Eric would only be involved in the creative side of the company, and that he'd have nothing to do with the business. Bush was supposed to handle the business, but once he quit, Siegel ended up having to work twice as many hours to deal with that situation as well. Kevin Sullivan was also sent home. The return of Bischoff and Russo was pushed as the pairing of the man who would turn the WCW around and the man who would turn the WWF around. To be fair, Bischoff had actually turned the company around twice, one for the better and one for the worst. Most in the company figured it was only a matter of time before the two self-destructed. Their personalities were such that it didn't seem possible for them to work together for any length of time. Russo, years later, had this to say about the pairing before it even took flight. I just knew that because of the differences in personalities, that it was only a matter of time before this experiment blew up in all of our faces. But again, I had to go along with it, because I had no choice. As long as I was still getting paid, I could handle it. Or so I thought. Bischoff noted that he liked Russo, at the beginning. Before long, though, things went south in a hurry. I didn't know how badly Russo wanted to be on TV. He was already a monster in many respects, but the newfound celebrity really got to him. He went off the deep end. Soon, the storyline was reality. Despite this, the two had allegedly been talking for a while. A month or so earlier, Siegel had asked Sullivan and his crew to come up with a booking plan for the rest of the year, or at least an overview of what they were going to do. Russo and Bischoff, at the same time, decided to submit a plan of their own. Their plan was basically to create a group of young guys headed by Russo to feud with a group of old guys headed by Bischoff. On the surface, this looked like a fine plan. At least it would get the young guys mixed up with the old guys and hopefully, in a perfect world, create some new stars. You all know the dilemma. WCW was absolutely not a perfect world. On WCW Live that week, Russo did what he did best. He talked about himself, and why it was everyone else's fault that things had tanked in late 1999. He also spun the numbers something fierce, claiming he took Nitro from a 2.5 to a 3.5 in 12 weeks. This, of course, would have made Bill Bush look like a major idiot if true. He said he'd wanted to bring Bischoff back for a long time, but during his first run, nobody went for it. Now he said Eric would be back leading the NWO, which would help turn things around. That, plus more emphasis on the cruiserweight division, would improve the situation. Keep in mind that in Russo's first run, the cruiserweight division was built around an Oklahoma versus Medusa feud. One of these wrestlers was not a cruiserweight, the other was not actually a man. He said the WWF turned around when DX went to that WCW show with a rocket launcher. Humorously, this was something WWE also claimed years later, mostly because Triple H was involved in that, and he was now married to Vince McMahon's daughter, Stephanie. In reality, that had approximately zero to do with it. He said he wanted Thunder moved back head-to-head with SmackDown. It had been switched from Thursday to Wednesday nights at the beginning of the year in an attempt to boost ratings, and Nitro head-to-head with Raw for both hours. Last, but not least, he said he wanted to bring Warrior back because, quote, in all honesty, there isn't anybody out there that wouldn't love to see a Goldberg versus Warrior match. Shockingly, Brad Siegel did not fire him the second that statement came out of his mouth. The March 27 Nitro was a fun little show, mainly because it was the annual spring breakout event in which the ring was set up poolside. This was a lame duck show, one of the last before Russo and Bischoff regained power, highlighted by a Hogan versus Wall feud that built throughout the show. It started with Gene Okerlund interviewing Hogan in mid-ring. As Hogan ranted and raved, a tiny figure in white appeared on top of a building about a mile away. The camera zoomed all the way in, but could barely make out this mysterious figure's identity. Hogan, who wore glasses in real life, immediately identified the person as the Wall. "The Wall!" he desperately screamed. "It's the Wall, brother!" The tiny figure raised a hand up in the air to signal for a chokeslam. Hogan took this as a challenge, and said he'd beat Wall up later. They ended up wrestling in the main event, and the match ended in a no contest when, after Wall actually kicked out of Hogan's vaunted leg drop of doom, Vampiro ran in. Wall got to chokeslam Hogan through a table afterward, but sadly for him, that was pretty much the end of their program. Also on the show, Sting beat Luger after he backdropped him into the ocean, and the referee counted the pin on the surface of the water. On April 3rd, the company ran a taped Nitro designed to set up the return of Bischoff and Russo, who had obviously lied months back when he said his face would never be shown on TV. Most mind-boggling was that, in hyping up the event, Tony Schiavone actually said that they were doing it to remind fans of how great Nitro used to be. Yes, he outright told viewers that Nitro used to be good, but it now sucked so bad that they were going to have to start over. Running a best-of program was actually an ingenious little ploy, because the taped Nothing Happening show drew a 1.78, which meant they had quite the number to build on. The show was a mix of factual and fictional history, mostly fictional, and in closing, announced that the teaming up of Russo and Bischoff was, literally, the biggest news of all time in professional wrestling. On April 10, they did their first show, and one thing was very clear. No matter what anyone wanted to say about Russo, he could write a hell of a first chapter. The problem, as would be made clear countless times down the road, was his inability to follow up on that first chapter and maintain momentum. The show was built around three men, Russo, Bischoff, and Hogan. The storyline that had Eric heading one group and Vinnie Roux heading another was thrown out in favor of having the two of them team up to lead a group of young guys, the New Blood, against the old dudes, the Millionaires Club. To their credit, they actually got two things to happen that most in wrestling thought were impossible. Flair wrestled his real-life nemesis Shane Douglas, and Hulk Hogan lost to Kidman, the guy who couldn't headline a flea market wrestling show. Well, that sounds all fine and dandy on paper. A distinction should be made between losing to someone and putting someone over. To put someone over means to make them look credible, like a real legitimate threat, an equal of sorts. Ric Flair put a lot of guys over in his career, meaning they beat him and in doing so became superstars. The best example of this, obviously, is Sting. At the very first Clash of the Champions, Flair allowed Sting to beat the crap out of him throughout their 45-minute match. It should be noted that Sting didn't even win that match. It was a draw. Despite this, Flair had done such a masterful job of making Sting out to be an equal that fans bought him as being on par with the Nature Boy. In essence, Flair made Sting a star in one night. Just losing to a person doesn't necessarily mean anything, and it was clear from the beginning that Hogan wasn't willing to do for Kidman what Flair had done for Sting. In their first match, Hogan beat the hell out of him the entire time, until Bischoff finally hit Hogan with a chair and Kidman got the pin. Even though Kidman, quote, won, the fans saw it for what it was. Hogan getting screwed, and Kidman merely being in the right place at the right time. In other words, Kidman didn't get over at all, and it was a waste of a match. Sadly, this trend was only just beginning. Also on the show, they announced that all the titles were being vacated. This led to one of the most telling moments of the year for the company, a moment they should have learned from, but didn't. Basically, Eric asked Sid to hand over the world title. Sid said no. So Eric made a crack about how he didn't have scissors. This was, of course, in regard to the UK hotel room incident 10 years ago, in which Sid and Arn got into a real fight, and Sid almost killed Arn with a pair of scissors. The announcers went crazy, feigning complete disbelief that Eric would say something like this. The crowd, however, sat there in complete silence. Eric figured they must not have heard him, so he said it again. Silence. The problem, of course, was that 99% of wrestling fans did not scour the internet for wrestling news every day, and probably only 5% of them, at most, had ever even heard of that story. Russo, however, who lived and died by the internet responses to his shows, was so surrounded by the medium that he concluded that every single fan had heard every single inside story that had ever happened in the business. The simplicity of wrestling booking is that it's fake, so you can make up any story you want, and as long as you push it hard on television, and it's even remotely credible, Fans are going to go along with it simply because they enjoy suspending their disbelief. The thing is, you have to push it hard on television. This was not the first or the last angle created on the assumption that fans knew way more than they actually did.